From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Next week, the Republican National Convention will be held in Philadelphia. Protesters from around the country will be coming, too, for a series of demonstrations and disruptions. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Thomas Ginsburg of the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's been covering the plans of protesters and the security plans of the city and the police. And we'll meet two leaders of groups planning protests. One group sued the city to get a permit to demonstrate. The other is planning 3 days of demonstrations without any permits. And world music critic Marlo Miles reviews CDs by two Latin performers. One is veteran Little Willie G. The other is newcomer Nava. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The investigation into yesterday's crash of a Concorde jet near Paris is now centering on an engine that was repaired shortly before the Air France plane took off from New York. The newly repaired engine burst into flame just after takeoff. The crash killed all 109 passengers on the supersonic jet and four more on the ground. Forensics experts are now trying to identify the remains of the passengers, most of whom were German tourists. Vice President Al Gore was in Chicago today with the Reverend Jesse Jackson at his side. Jackson lashed out at Dick Cheney, George W. Bush's running mate, calling the former defense secretary a wolf in sheep's clothing. Tony Sarabia reports from Chicago Public Radio.
Mr. Jackson will have a prominent role in next month's Democratic National Convention, where Gore campaign officials hope he can help bring together the party. While introducing Vice President Gore at a gathering at his Rainbow Push Coalition headquarters in Chicago, Jackson took a swipe at Republican vice presidential pick Dick Cheney.
According to Business Week, the record of Dick Cheney rivals that of Jesse Helms. Beneath the veneer lies an individual of extreme views.
Mr. Jackson went on to cite a number of issues he says Cheney voted against while he was a Washington lawmaker, such as equal rights for women, nutrition for children, and civil rights for all. For NPR News, I'm Tony Sarabia in Chicago.
A federal appeals court in New Jersey ruled today that the state's law banning late-term abortions is unconstitutional. State Republican leaders overrode a veto from New Jersey Governor Christy Whitman to force the measure into law. The appeals court said that New Jersey's law is similar to a Nebraska law that was found unconstitutional last month by the U.S. Supreme Court. New figures from the government show that more women are getting mammograms on a regular basis. NPR's John Hamilton reports.
The figures come from a comprehensive report on the nation's health. It was released Wednesday by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. According to the report, 69% of women age 50 or older said they'd had a mammogram within the past 2 years. That's up from 61% in 1994 and just 27% in 1987. Women with low incomes were less likely than more affluent women to have mammograms. In 1998, about half reported a recent exam. Regular mammograms can help detect breast cancer in its early stages when the disease is most curable. Government researchers say that may be one reason the increase in mammography has been accompanied by a decline in deaths from breast cancer. Government officials say the exam is likely to become even more common because of expanded coverage under Medicare. John Hamilton, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks, the Dow lost 183 points today, 1.7%. It closed at 10,516. This is NPR. Canada announced today that it's extending diplomatic recognition to North Korea. Until now, Italy was the only one of the major industrial nations to recognize the isolated communist country. Canada's Foreign Affairs Minister, Lloyd Axworthy, says the two nations will hold talks soon on establishing full diplomatic relations, including establishing embassies in one another's capitals. Microsoft has asked the Supreme Court to send the appeal of its antitrust case to a lower court first. The company said a court of appeals should look at the case so that the high court doesn't have to deal with the large number of technical issues involved. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
The Department of Justice has asked the Supreme Court for a direct appeal of the case, bypassing the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. But Microsoft says that would impose what it called an extraordinary burden on the Supreme Court. The company's filing said the district court's ruling dealt with highly technical issues that should be winnowed down by the appeals court. Microsoft complained that District Judge Thomas Penfield Jackson should be replaced for granting interviews to the media and because of what the company feels are procedural errors committed during the trial. Microsoft is hoping the appeals court will dismiss some of the lower court's findings. That would leave the Supreme Court with a much narrower set of facts to review once the case gets that far. The Supreme Court may not decide until the fall whether to hear the case. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the technology-heavy NASDAQ Composite Index lost 41 points, or just over 1%. It closed at 3,987. The S&P 500 lost 22 points to close at 1,452. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's not just Republicans from around the country who are on their way to Philadelphia, which will host the GOP convention next week. Protesters from around the country are coming, too. Many of them are part of the coalition of groups that demonstrated in Seattle last December during the meeting of the World Trade Organization. About 30,000 people demonstrated in Seattle. Those demonstrations were largely peaceful, but they stopped traffic and delayed meetings. A small group of protesters, estimated at 100 or 200 people, smashed the windows of some businesses. Police used tear gas and arrested about 600 demonstrators in Seattle. The National Guard was called in. The city of Philadelphia has tried to restrict protests to an area around the convention center. However, one group sued and won the right to stage their demonstration in the central part of the city. Another coalition is planning to demonstrate without a permit. Later, we'll meet two of the protest organizers. My guest, Thomas Ginsburg, is a staff writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's been covering the planning of the protests as well as the city and police department's security plans. I asked Ginsburg to describe the range of groups expected to participate in the demonstrations.
There's a really wide range of groups, and it's somewhat like it has been at all conventions. There are pro-life groups and pro-choice and gun groups and both sides. Those are probably the same numbers they were at past conventions. The difference this time, as far as we can tell, is a large number of people who haven't previously taken part in conventions, at least since 68 and 72, people who have really been energized by what happened in Seattle in November and in Washington last April, people who are generally very critical of undemocratic tendencies, they say, in the globalization trend in IMF and the World Bank and so forth. They have put together various coalitions to put on large protests here. Only a couple of those have actually gotten permits to have protests. So that has caused some tension with the city. The rest of them are going to go ahead and protest anyway. It'll be a big mixture of things.
What are some of the concerns that the city of Philadelphia has after what happened in Seattle?
Well, the city was preparing for protests before Seattle. But afterwards, Philadelphia, like most large cities all over the country, became very concerned about what happened in Seattle, whole blocks taken over and buildings smashed and windows smashed. They reacted then in particular, and also like Los Angeles did, by bringing in specialists to train them on crowd control. The FBI came in and did special trainings and briefings on intelligence that they had. A lot of this targeting groups that had been in Seattle, not necessarily involved in the violence. So to some extent, it was a very harsh reaction, defensible or not. That is what they've done. And since then, they've moved to do, they've done trainings of police officers here in special crowd control. They've gotten new equipment. They have passed a city ordinance. They had gotten a mask ordinance in Philadelphia, which several other cities also have and has been upheld as legal, but Philadelphia didn't have one, and now it does, where you're not allowed to wear a mask in the commission of a crime.
So how does that ordinance pertain to demonstrations?
Well, there was some sightings of anarchists, mainly anarchists in Seattle, who were involved in some of the direct action there, who were accused of being the ones breaking windows, and I guess people believe the wearing of masks during some of that was allowed them to do it or to hide their identity. It's a reaction mainly against anything they can't get their handle on and don't really know how to control. I'm not sure that anyone thinks that this mask ordinance is going to really do anything to control anything in Philadelphia, but it's one more sign of what they've tried to do.
What have you been able to find out about police surveillance of the groups intending to protest during the convention?
Well, a lot of what's been going on, again, in Philadelphia and all over the country is intelligence gathering after Seattle and people trying to, law enforcement trying to find out who's doing what and planning what. In Philadelphia, the police department here has a long history of doing surveillance of protest groups of activists. This is not something new. When it began, however, the police department completely denied that it was doing it. In fact, said that we can't do it because we've been forbidden by a consent decree from 1987 to do it, which left everyone scratching their heads and some people still accusing the police. The fact that later the police last week admitted that it was their people doing surveillance is yet another sign that it seems to me that the police and the city officials are trying to be really tough and at the same time not really knowing how to present themselves as a city of brotherly love and free liberty here. The surveillance, as far as we know, has been mainly from outside buildings during meetings to photograph or watch people coming in and out of meetings. We don't know for certain of anything more than that. The 1987 decree actually applied only to infiltration and the bugging of offices, and we don't know that that's happening.
You reported on a police tip sheet about a month ago. What was that tip sheet? Who wrote it? Who was it sent to? What was it about?
Another something that the police haven't entirely fessed up to, but it is a tip sheet that was put together through police sources, at least, that listed everything that any law enforcement or security agency, private security agency, should look for during the protest. It included things like look for the theft of chains or PVC piping, which is construction piping that can be used to make barricades. Look for any large increase of strangers in a neighborhood, and particularly look for an increase in the number of white male and female youths with colorful hair and body piercings as a sign of activists moving in and getting ready to do something. It was a quite interesting remark in this tip sheet, not only because it's a very sensitive sort of generalization to make, but the protesters themselves have been very sensitive to the fact that in Seattle, certainly, a lot of the protests involve a lot of whites instead of people of color and minorities. And there's been a lot of discussion in their planning groups how to bring more minority groups into the protests. And they emphasize a lot how there are a lot of particularly African-American groups that are affected by government policies that don't take part in these street actions, and we should remember them. However, if you go to any of their meetings, it is 95% young white people. So they do have a situation here, and the police have recognized it.
What are some of the restrictions that the city of Philadelphia has put around protests, where you can protest?
The city tried to do, or did actually, what most cities have done for conventions for the last 12 years at least, established a special zone near the convention site where they set up a lottery system where people can pick and choose a number and have a time slot to protest within sight of the convention. And it's a legal area where they can control it, and it's corralled, and they build a fence for them, and they set up a sound system, and they do all this preparation. And it's initially meant to give a place for activists to make their message known without disrupting the going on of the convention. The problem is that in almost every city where it's been done, it's been challenged legally, or it's been challenged at least politically in the city as an unfair attempt to corral people. You can't put free speech in a box, so to speak. And at every convention, it's also been upheld as legal in the courts. And just last week, a federal judge in Los Angeles, on a case that had been brought by the ACLU out there, ruled that the placement of the free speech zone near the Staples Center in Los Angeles was unconstitutional because it was out of line of sight of the convention site. It didn't rule against the zone itself, just the placement. Philadelphia had a different kind of legal challenge where the zone here was never a point of contention because none of the activists here wanted to use it. They basically ignored it. They scorned it. They didn't want to have any part with it. They wanted to have a protest right in the middle of town. And the city refused initially, told them to go to the protest site. They said no. They ended up suing, also with the help of the ACLU, under abridgment of First Amendment freedoms, and won a settlement, basically, and got their permit. As a result of that fight in Philadelphia, there are two permitted rallies, two major permitted rallies, both before the convention, one on Sunday, just before, and one on Saturday. There have been, as of this point, as far as we can tell, no permits for major demonstrations, street demonstrations, during the convention itself, outside this protest zone. And the city is pretty much sticking to that.
But there are major demonstrations that are planned in spite of the city's restrictions.
Oh, and there's a lot of that. Now, there's going to be probably three days of unauthorized, unpermitted protests, and they've given a theme for each day. A lot of the planning for this also involves arrests, and to some extent, arrests are the very point of the protest, to get arrested, to make a point. That's what civil disobedience is intended to do. There will be various kinds of direct action where surprise banners being raised on high-rises or wherever it might be, or people suddenly locking themselves to a shuttle bus where delegates are supposed to use to get to their restaurant or something. There'll be things like that. They haven't, of course, told me all their details, and I don't think they want to tell anyone. That's the point, but they want to be secret. And a lot of these people are veterans of Seattle and Washington, and they've learned their lessons from there, just as the police have learned from watching Seattle and Washington. And it looks like the city will turn into a kind of running daily game of cat and mouse, as far as I can tell, where you will have smaller groups of protesters, they call affinity groups, attempting direct action or attempting to block a street, dashing from one place to another, and police in what they call mobile field forces, where they will be in probably unmarked cars, dashing from place to place to catch the activists to try to keep the streets open. It'll be a dramatic few days anyway.
Since some of these protests involve civil disobedience and a lot of people are planning on getting arrested, what kind of plans has the city of Philadelphia made to accommodate the people who they arrest?
This has been has recently become a point of contention. The city didn't really have a very good facility to put a lot of protesters. It had to look for detention centers, and it looked for them in areas that would be far from Center City, where people who are detained, if they are released, can't easily get back to the action. So they have settled on Holmesburg Prison, which has been closed, which was closed for being a dungeon-like place, and they are trying to bring it back up to a facility where they can safely keep people. There is also going to be federal facilities, apparently going to be one at a naval supply center, where they will be processing people. In the technicalities of this, if someone is arrested on federal property versus state or city property, they have to be processed differently. So that's why that's happening.
My guest is Thomas Ginsberg, a staff writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. you're just joining us, my guest is Thomas Ginsburg. He's a staff writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's one of a group of reporters who have been covering plans for the Republican National Convention in Philadelphia. And Thomas Ginsburg is focusing on protests and security plans. What kind of pressures are on the Philadelphia police now to make sure that there isn't violence in the streets, that businesses are protected if there are attempts to smash windows or do any actions that would directly affect the businesses? After all, it's the businesses who were just dying to get the convention here, yeah, thinking how good it was going to be for business.
Yeah, it's an interesting problem the city has found itself in. And from what I can tell, one that it didn't expect. Philadelphia is, of course, a historic city and the cradle of liberty, and we're the Liberty Bell and all that the Republicans would like to glom onto. And the city would like to promote that image as being welcoming and being fair and open. And it seems to me that this impulse has really come into conflict with its concurrent need to provide a lot of security and a very smooth-running convention so that the city's convention and tourism business, which has become the base, or at least what some officials would like to be the base of the economy here, will really grow as a result of this convention, and that people will see it as a stable, safe, prosperous city to work in. And in some instances, these two goals cross. It's really a security continuum in a way, the crossing of safety with liberties. You if you leave everything wide open, it's not going to be very safe, and vice versa. So in statements made by the past the Rendell administration and by the current Street administration here, you find them very often on both sides of this question, and those two things come into conflict. And we saw about a week ago when building inspectors shut down quite summarily and in apparently without much oversight from the higher-ups in the administration, shut down a studio where protesters were making puppets and floats for the convention, for their protest for the convention. Within hours of that, the Street administration intervened and had the studio reopened. And they acknowledged very clearly, it makes us look bad. We can't do this.
Have you talked to anybody from the FBI at all? Do you know if the FBI is in on the security planning?
Oh, FBI, ATF, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, the Secret Service is the lead coordinator for the whole thing. The Capitol Police from Washington will be here with every congressman and senator. A state police contingent from every state that is sending a governor, and that's 35 Republican governors. That's a lot of state police. There are dozens of law enforcement agencies that will be here. The FBI's role is going to be a little unique here because Philadelphia does have a lot of federal property, and they formally have responsibility for law enforcement on federal property, whereas everything else will largely be left to the police, at least initially. The FBI is on top of that, contributing a lot of intelligence gathering and technical resources. They will apparently be bringing an entire electronic command center that will be connected directly with their facilities in Virginia to do very instant background checks and intelligence gathering on people that they may come across.
One of the unique things about the new wave of protests, the anti-corporate protests that we've been seeing since Seattle, is that these groups are really organized through the internet, and that there's just a lot of disparate groups who can interconnect around common causes through the internet. That means that other people can tap into the communications on the internet too. Do you know if the police have been using the internet to study up on the protest groups?
Oh, absolutely. The internet has been a fantastic way to cover what's been going on and to see by reporters and by law enforcement. There are dozens of listservs, which are email networks that are like giant bulletin boards, basically, and you put one message out there and it goes to hundreds of people who are subscribed to that listserv, and police can easily subscribe law enforcement, and they do. They've told me they do. They read them all the time, just like I do, just like a lot of other reporters do. You can get a lot of information about what people are thinking, what they'd like to do, but it is only information. It is doesn't mean that it's good or accurate. And this is one way very helpful to reporting, and I imagine to law enforcement, in another way a bit frustrating because everything has to be run down and checked. And I personally, professionally have a rule that I don't report things that I've seen on the internet unless I've checked them out directly, either with the person or the group, or to put it in perspective, it can be very dicey. It can be basically a very profitable tip sheet. Let's put it that way.
Do you think, because of all these concerns about security now surrounding the Republican National Convention, do you think that there's going to be a diminished desire in the future for cities to attract the convention? I mean, cities have competed so hard to get the convention in their hometown, hoping it would generate good publicity, hoping it would generate a lot of profits for businesses and hotels. And now with the protests and the security plans and the anti-corporate politics behind the protests, I'm not sure the businesses are going to be too excited to have major events like this in their backyard anymore.
That's a foreseeing of the future that I can't do that. I guess we'll have to wait and see what cities do. I can't imagine that no matter how many demonstrators take to a street that a business is going to say they don't like the business. I mean, protesters are going to bring business here too. One of them just told me, well, we'll buy lots of pizza. That accounts for business. I think the factors that make a city decide that it wants a convention probably are not going to go away. And I think those are probably pretty strongly there politically as far as the anti-corporate message. Whether that becomes an agenda item for either of the parties is a different question that might have an effect. I mean, if a political party comes into town with an anti-corporate message, that may be different than protesters.
Well, Thomas Ginsburg, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thomas Ginsburg is a staff writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. We'll meet two protest organizers in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Eddie Bauer, supporting radio expeditions and offering outdoor-inspired clothing, accessories, and home furnishings. In stores, catalogs, and at eddiebauer.com. And from Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of Driving Myself Crazy, The Misadventures of a Novice Golfer by Jessica Maxwell. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, leaders of two coalitions planning demonstrations during the Republican National Convention. One group sued the city to gain a permit to demonstrate. The other has no permit and is planning 3 days of civil disobedience. Also, Milo Miles reviews CDs by veteran performer Little Willie G and debut artist Nava.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The city of Philadelphia has tried to restrict demonstrations during the Republican National Convention to a confined area near the convention center, which is outside of the downtown area. But one umbrella group, Unity 2000, sued the city and won the right to hold a demonstration on city streets. With me is one of the organizers of that group, Mike Morrow. This coalition includes labor, environmental, civil rights, feminist, and gay rights groups. Another umbrella group is planning a series of demonstrations and disruptions on city streets in spite of the fact they have no permit to demonstrate. One demonstration will focus on welfare rights and the rights of the homeless, another on what they describe as the criminal injustice system. The group organizing these unpermitted demonstrations is called the Philadelphia Direct Action Group, known by its acronym PDAG. Joining us is a leader of that group, Amy Kwasnicki. I asked Mike Morrell why his group was initially denied a permit to protest.
Well, the simple answer is that the Republicans were given full control over every public venue in the city, which prevented any groups from having any kind of permit. That was for the week prior to the convention and during the convention. That was unprecedented. No other city had ever given such a carte blanche to any party, Republican or Democrat, before. And so when we applied, we were actually turned down twice for our permit. And we went to the ACLU. They looked at the agreement that the city had signed with the Republicans and were just outraged, because it was clear that not only were they trying to accommodate the Republican Party, but they were trying to squelch any kind of dissent. They created what they called a First Amendment zone, which we called a protest pit. But we think the First Amendment zone is actually what they had in mind, that the First Amendment would only be in application only within this little fenced-in area, and the rest of the city, nobody could have any free speech. And I want to make it clear that what we have decided to do by applying for a permit is not in any way to denigrate the way that other people are organizing. As a matter of fact, we think it's a strength that we have many different ways for people to participate, whether it's through direct action, civil disobedience, going to educational forums or teach-ins, or participating in permitted rallies. All of those are valid forms of expression, and all of them, we think, are really under what should be the real protest permit, and that's the Constitution of the United States.
On what grounds did you finally win the permit?
We went before Judge Fulham in federal court, and Judge Fulham was the judge who put the city of Philadelphia under a permanent injunction to obey the First Amendment, the only city in the history of the United States to have that distinction. And he looked at the agreement, he looked at the city and said, you better find a way to settle this fast. And so the city, realizing that they were going to lose, came back and talked with us and decided that they not only had to settle and give us the permit, but they also ended up having to provide a lot of the services that we would otherwise have had to pay for.
Amy, did your group, Philadelphia Direct Action Group, try to get a permit?
No.
Why not?
We don't have the resources to sue the city. I mean, we don't. There's no way we could go through that kind of a process.
What?
As far as I know, there's only one. There's one other group that did apply for a permit, which is Kensington Welfare Rights Union, and they were denied.
Why not just protest in the area set aside for protests?
Because we would be supporting a mockery of democracy. I mean, we are patriots. We believe in this country. We believe in the right to go out in the streets is a viable part of democracy. And if we cannot do that, then there's something seriously, seriously wrong with what's going on here. And under that rubric, we're going to do it anyway.
Do you expect to be arrested for protesting without a permit?
The city government has made it very clear that they're going to arrest people who go out in their own streets while the Republicans are here. As far as the city seems to be concerned, as long as the Republican National Convention is here, our city belongs to the Republicans. We don't agree.
Let me read something from the PDAG, the Philadelphia Direct Action Group, website. One, we are organizing nonviolent direct action in response to the Republican National Convention. Two, our meetings are not a forum to plan property destruction. Three, we will not use drugs or alcohol during the planning or execution of our actions. Our meetings are not a forum to plan property destruction. The meetings aren't a forum to plan it, but would you condone it if it happened?
We have specifically asked that people respect the fact that we live here. I mean, this is our city. I mean, one of the things that has been much in the media since Seattle is that issue of property destruction. Interestingly, what's been overlooked is there was some property destruction in Seattle. Yes, some windows got smashed. Those were the windows of large multinational corporate business that is one of the perpetrators. No local business experienced any property destruction in Seattle. There was no property destruction at all in D.C. We recognize that, and we've asked people to not engage in property destruction if they're coming to participate in our activities.
Even of businesses that are part of multinational corporations?
Yes.
And it says we will not use drugs or alcohol during the planning or execution of our actions.
Yes.
What happens if someone who wants to tag along in the demonstration happens to be very drunk or using drugs and they're acting in a way that you feel is incongruent with your group? What would you do?
We ask them to leave and hope that they will. And if they don't, we escort them. We do have security. We do have people who have been trained to help keep our spaces secure. What we are doing is already too filled with tension to have the unpredictable factor of someone being drunk or on drugs around.
Also on the PDEG website, it says PDEG invites you to disrupt the Republican National Convention. What do you mean by disrupt?
I don't know. We will see. Our organization operates through a consensus process of decision-making, which means everyone has an equal voice. And through the course of this week, which is preceding the convention, we are having meetings and people are talking and figuring out what's going to occur.
Either of your groups planning acts of civil disobedience, and if so, what do you consider to be the most effective expression of civil disobedience for your causes?
Well, Unity 2000 had made a decision early on not to do that.
It's why?
Because we wanted a place where people could come who are not activists necessarily, to join with activists, to learn from people who are more veterans in some of the movements, where they could get literature, where they could hear speeches that could educate and motivate them, where they could hear music that could inspire them. It was not at all about tactics. I've been arrested 30 or 40 times myself. I've spent time in jail. So it's not about saying that this is a good way to do things or a bad way, but we wanted to provide different venues and different avenues for people to participate.
Yeah, it seems like you need the legitimacy of a permitted march in order to, well, have legitimacy. But then if you just go, I mean, there have been so many massive marches in this country that have gotten no media attention, no press, no attention from the politicians. It's like you have to have people who are willing to go out there and commit acts of civil disobedience in order to prove that you mean it and that it is extreme, that it is important, that we are in a state of emergency. And then you also need the permanent marches for legitimacy. I mean, it's part of the power of what occurred in the protests of the World Trade Organization, as well as the protests of the IMF and the World Bank, is that it's not just a radical fringe, nor is it just those bleeding heart liberals going out in the street again with their permit. It's all of us working together, demanding massive social and political change.
So you are planning acts of civil disobedience?
Yes.
Could you tell us what some of the plans are, or is that something you're trying to keep secret?
Again, that's secret. Well, it's not about keeping it secret. It's that we feel an important part of what we are doing is it's not only that we're going to go out in the street. The process by which we end up there is an alternative in and of itself, because we are not a top-down hierarchical decision-making process. It's not that there are five of us somewhere who plan something out and we're now telling people what to do. We are sitting together in a room, direct, participatory, face-to-face democracy, and we are figuring it out together, what's going to happen.
So you're saying you don't know yet, or you want to keep the element of surprise?
Well, I sincerely don't know. I haven't been able to make it to any of the meetings.
But any demonstration that takes place without a permit is de facto civil disobedience. And the fact that the city refuses to give permits to groups like the Kensington Welfare Rights Union for a planned peaceful march down Broad Street toward the First Union Center says that those people will be arrested if they continue on after the police tell them to stop. That's an act of civil disobedience.
Do either of you think that you or other members of your coalition have been subjected to police surveillance.
Oh, yes.
Absolutely.
Yes, I mean, we have been, the surveillance has been going on for quite a while. We have pictures of the people who are taking pictures of us. And when those people were directly questioned, they claimed to not be able to tell us who they represented or who they worked for. Very recently, though, it became public that it's the police, it's the city police force that's been surveilling us. They were specifically targeting the places where we've been trying to have our meetings. But in addition to that, for months now, our garbage has been getting picked through to the point now that we don't throw any paper out. I mean, it's not that there's anything that important in our paper, but it's still disturbing to have people hanging out in your alleyway going through your garbage.
Yeah, I recently spoke at a training in Windsor, Ontario, prior to the Organization of American States meeting, and was held by immigration, going to Canada for 4 hours, was interrogated for 3 hours. Every piece of paper that I had in my possession was copied, including my date book, including all my address book and everything. Just two nights ago, I was handing out flyers, and somebody said, "You're Mike Morrell, aren't you?" Mispronouncing my name, as people usually do. And I said, "Yeah," and I couldn't place who it was. And I said, "I'm sorry, I don't remember your name." And he said, "Oh, I'm Sergeant so-and-so," which really frightened me, because here I am in doing a completely legal activity, and the police are there monitoring it, and also knew me, knew who I was before I introduced myself.
I'm wondering if either of you plan on voting.
Yes.
Yes.
So although you think the two major parties are both in the pockets of large corporations, I think you've made that clear. So but you're going to vote maybe not necessarily for those two parties, or you're going to choose among them? Or?
I have nightmares about Republicans. I'm going to vote for Gore because even though there's not that big of a difference between the two, if we have a Republican president, I'm sorry, I really sincerely have nightmares.
I'm not going to reveal who I'm voting for, because we're really...
that is your privilege.
What we're trying to organize for the Sunday march and rally is something that's issue-based, and I don't want to confuse the issue. And my vote is personal. However, it's going to be a real struggle, because there's the two old parties don't represent anybody. I don't really like to call them the major parties. I like to call them either the old parties or the corporate parties, because that's what they are.
That's a much better answer.
My guests are Amy Kwasnicki and Mike Morrell, two of the organizers of the demonstrations planned during the Republican National Convention next week in Philadelphia. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Amy Kwasnicki of the Philadelphia Direct Action Group, or PDAG, and Mike Morrell of the coalition group Unity 2000. Their groups are planning major demonstrations in Philadelphia during the Republican National Convention. Morrell's group has a permit to protest. Kwasnicki's group will hold unauthorized demonstrations. Do you consider the target of your demonstrations in Philadelphia to be the Republican National Convention, the public, the media, global corporations, or who?
well, this isn't. Let me just speak for Unity 2000.
Yeah.
For the Sunday rally. What we are doing is not targeting the Republicans. I think most of the people organizing feel that at least the people within the convention hall are beyond hope. That they are so owned by the corporate powers that they're not going to hear anything unless there are coins jingling in their pockets. So we are, in essence, totally ignoring the Republicans, and what we are trying to do is reach out to the American public. We are creating an event that's going to be a festive street fair. There are going to be puppets, if they aren't all confiscated by the police before then. There are going to be floats. There are going to be balloons. There's going to be wonderful music from all over the world on the stage, inspiring speakers, tables with information from dozens of organizations. It's really going to be a festive atmosphere. And what we're hoping is that somebody's going to be watching this live on C-SPAN, and they're going to say, wow, I wish I were in Philadelphia. That looks like a great thing. People from all different backgrounds, ethnic groups, ages, queer and straight, all kinds of folks having a really good, fun time. And then they're going to turn on the TV the next night, and they're going to look at the inside of the First Union Center, and they're going to see a sea of rich white men, primarily, and trying to show some enthusiasm by waving some signs on cue, but everything is scripted, and you can tell that everything has been, there are signs from corporations all over the place. And without ever hearing one word from either event, they'll have two completely different visions of the future of this country. One which is multicultural and respects differences and accepts people for who they are, and the other which is controlled by corporations and domination by a few rich folks.
Is C-SPAN going to be covering your demonstration?
Yes.
And we are not by any means pro-Democrat. This is not this is not an anti-Republican event. This is, it is not a pro-Democrat event. It is these demonstrations, the marches, the rallies, the civil disobedience is all to say that we will not allow this business as usual approach that our government takes. I mean, we have two parties, but it is really just one party, and they are beholden to whoever's lining their pockets, not to us.
Ever since the Seattle protests, there's been a lot of attention to organizing on the internet. You know, the internet as being a new tool for political organizing that has changed the way coalitions can come together and communicate. And Mike, let me ask you, because you've been at this job of organizing for, I suspect, many years.
Too many.
Yeah. do you feel that the internet is changing organizing from the way it was when you started?
Yeah. Absolutely.
How?
Well, for instance, when I mentioned the caravan that we organized, we were able to reach out to and get human rights activists and folks from all over the world to participate in this caravan instantly. During Seattle, we keep talking about November 30th in Seattle as this great event where there were 40, 50, 60,000 people in the streets, which was great. But via the internet, there were simultaneous events taking place around the world. There were 75,000 people in the streets in France. There was a friend called me up and told me about this small event that he had in Bangalore, India, and there were only 10,000 people there. But there were literally over a million people in the street all over the world because the people were able to interact instantly via email and websites. The difference isn't as profound, though, as one thinks, because it's organizing still is the same old thing. You have to get out and talk to people. You have to go out and go to meetings. You have to go to where people are. You have to hand out flyers. You have to make phone calls. The thing that the internet has done is made our job easier about sharing information. It's a great tool, but it doesn't replace the old kind of organizing. But I wanted to pick up on something that Amy had said earlier about all of the new faces that are involved in the movement, and that's really exciting. I'm 45, and I've been doing this for 25 or 30 years now, and until the last couple of years, even in my 40s, when I'd go to meetings, people would talk about the young people and look at me. And I'm not one of the young people anymore, but when we were having meetings, that's what was happening. In the last couple of years, it's been really exciting to watch as truly young people are getting involved in these movements and actually taking the leadership. And that's exciting, and that's really going to change things in this country.
Well, do you think there are generational differences between the older people in the movement and the younger people in the movement, both in terms of their goals and their tactics?
Well, I would say that definitely in terms of the decision-making behind the process, like, I mean, PDAG is operating very differently than Unity 2000, for example, and PDAG is majority, like, late teen to mid-20s.
So what are the differences?
Well, again, it's a consensus process. We really believe that it's not just the end product, but also the means by which we get there. And so we have a lot of meetings. And spend a lot of time talking and making decisions on a face-to-face basis. And while the internet has definitely made some aspects of organizing easier, really, I think the only way you can have democracy is by face-to-face sitting down and talking. And I think it's one of the problems in the larger picture with a representational democracy like what we have. We can't talk to our politicians. So for us, the actual means we are utilizing to create this protest is an alternative.
Mike, I wonder if you're experiencing at all the feeling of that younger people who are organizing now are going through the joy of consensus politics. And do you feel like you went through that and then reached a dead end and moved to another place after that?
No, I think that consensus definitely has its place. There are times, though, when I found that a more majority rules type of thing, which is a little more hierarchical but still democratic, has its place as well. And especially when you're dealing with people who do have to hold down jobs. A lot of our folks are working people. They're almost all working people holding down jobs, raising families. And so they don't have as much time to spend in as many meetings. The consensus model is great. It's very time-consuming, as Amy mentioned. And when you have the time to utilize it, I think it's the best way to do it. But so it's not a matter of not thinking it's a good way to organize. It's just that we chose a different model because of the folks who were involved and the time that they had to commit.
Mike Morrill is an organizer of Unity 2000. Amy Kwasnicki is one of the leaders of PDAG, the Philadelphia Direct Action Group. Both groups are planning demonstrations during the Republican National Convention. We called the Philadelphia Police Department to ask how it plans on handling the unauthorized demonstrations. We were told the police have no statement now, but they will hold a press conference tomorrow about their plans for handling protests. Coming up, two new CDs by Latin performers, a veteran and a newcomer. This is Fresh Air. Two new Latin records have caught the attention of music critic Milo Miles. One is by veteran performer Little Willie G from East L.A., and the other is the debut album from Puerto Rican songwriter Nava.
Willie Garcia started more than 35 years ago as one of the original Chicano soul rockers. He lit up the clubs of East L.A. as the lead singer for The Midnighters, an outfit as sweet and tough as they come. After losing his way in the usual self-destructive detours, Little Willie G became an ordained minister in 1984. Perhaps Saving Souls has preserved his own because he's come all the way back with his new record, Make Up for the Lost Time. Willie G's voice is light and sweet. That fits in well with L.A.'s East Side sound, which has always stuck close to doo-wop and even lounge ballads. With typically meticulous help from producer David Hidalgo of Los Lobos, Make Up for the Lost Time is a modern soul record that doesn't sound like either Motown or Memphis.
Fall.
Willie G. writes good tunes and picks even better ones, from an Aretha Franklin chestnut to the first hit by George Clinton's Parliaments. The only mistake is the sappy finish, Bobby Womack's A World Where No One Cries. Because after all, a world where no one cries would be a world where no one laughs either. If Willie G. benefits from years of seasoning as a performer, Nava's debut album shows surprising grace for a first-timer. He's known as a veteran songwriter, not a performer, and his album, Nava, confirms that he's only an adequate plus singer. But the record is also a rare thing, a triumph of hip professionalism. A bunch of savvy old hands get together and sound like hotshot newcomers.
Algunos tienen su cielo, algunos lloran y lloran, y otros se ríen del tiempo, algunos viven deprisa, porque no entienden la calma, y algunos buscan placer, y otros el dolor los acompaña.
It isn't so much that Nava grafts hip-hop or sampling or electronica or whatever onto his Puerto Rican rhythms, though he does do that. It's that the album delivers the urban bustle, the high-tech ease, which feels modern instead of trendy. And yet the acoustic guitars and accordion keep the past close at hand. I wish Nava's songs had more to say, maybe stopped for a knockout trombone solo from Juan Castillo. But as with Little Willie G, Nava could easily become a small favorite.
Milo Miles is music editor for Rock.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurok directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Cada cual hace del mundo un mundo de cada cual. Todo estaba frente a mí,
todo estaba frente a mí,
justo muy dentro de mí,
justo muy dentro de mí.
Todo estaba frente a mí,
todo estaba frente a mí,
justo muy dentro de mí,
justo muy dentro de mí.
El paraíso nunca se perdió, el paraíso siempre estaba aquí. El paraíso nunca se perdió, el paraíso siempre estaba aquí. Por eso no te culpo ni te quiero hacer.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, an e-commerce transactions company providing end-to-end solutions for the development and deployment of e-business applications. BEA.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperbacks Division, publisher of Turn of the Century, a novel by Kurt Anderson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how Philadelphia won the bid to host the Republican National Convention and what it's done to prepare for it. We talk to Philadelphia Daily News reporter Dave Davies, and we talk with the author of a new biography of composer Aaron Copland. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.